Hi, Anish. Welcome to the Big Unlock podcast.
Right. And thank you so much.
Very happy to have you here, Anish. I'll do a quick intro from my side and hand it right back to you.
Okay.
I'm Rohit Mahajan, and I'm the managing partner and CEO at Bigrio and Demo Consulting. It is great to know that you're already familiar with Demo from your previous interactions with Paddy. We are continuing to build on the Big Unlock podcast that he left us. We are in the season 6 now. So welcome, and over to you.
Well, thank you, Rohit. And I'll begin by just saying the obvious, how grateful I am that you've picked up the baton. Paddy was a bigger than life individual and had a lot of fans, mine included. And so let me just say at the outset, how I'm grateful that you've done this. By way of background, my name is Anish Chopra. I currently am the Chief Strategy Officer at Arcadia. We're a market leader in putting healthcare data to work in areas of value-based care for payers and providers. And we're mostly focused on making sure individuals get access to the best possible care at every step of their journey. So that's a big part of what we do. But my personal passion is the handoff between the private sector and the public sector and how we can better collaborate. I did serve in the Obama administration as the chief technology officer, was honored to be the first in our country in a position that's been bipartisan. It's been a nice tradition that the Trump administration has continued, and grateful for the chance to demonstrate what's possible when you apply technology, data, and innovation to solve some of the country's biggest challenges.
That's great to know, Anish. Could you tell us and share with us that what attracted you to healthcare in the first place?
How did I was timing, like everything. I was an undergraduate student at Johns Hopkins in the early 90s when President Bill Clinton called the country's attention to improving the healthcare system. And I had the pleasure of going all in, both as a student and then later as an intern for a Maryland version of what Bill Clinton was calling for, led by the university's president. And so I had a bit of an insider track to see what it would look like to be a part of the future. And I knew very strongly that the best of our country is when the collaboration exists between the public sector and the private sector. And in the health area, particularly, this is one of the moments of our generation. And today has not seen the benefits of productivity, has not been as modernized with respect to technology adoption and use. But we have the greatest opportunity to democratize high quality care if we could close that gap. So my passion in the 90s was around the role of internet technologies in healthcare as a way to democratize. I might have been overexcited about that chapter than the impact, but I feel doubly as excited in today's AI era to do the same. So I find it to be my life's work to try to unlock this. And we'll look back on a time to say, wow, can you imagine we had spent so much as a society on healthcare and got so little? Wow, couldn't we be where we are today in the future, which is that it's going to be much lower cost and much better outcomes for everyone?
Absolutely. So that's great to know, Anish. And that brings me to the comment that we were just talking about previous to starting the podcast about making use meaningful again. That's a great catchphrase. I would like you to please explain your thought process behind it and what it means to the health systems, to the patients, and to the larger population in general.
Well, thank you so much. By way of background, your audience likely remembers the term meaningful use. Two words that Congress wrote into the High-Tech Act that really led us on the journey of how to basically accelerate the adoption and use of health information technology since the late 2000s, so roughly 2010 and on, when the subsidies kicked in. This has always been a trade-off, Rohit. What is the definition of meaningful use? Well, if you and I go down the street to a Best Buy and we purchase software, the software is supposed to do certain things, maybe TurboTax to help us file our taxes. And so we buy the software and we expect that it's going to help us collect the data that we need to file taxes. So you can almost just say, basically, if you're going to subsidize something, I'll give you my Best Buy receipt and I will file my taxes and it'll be cheaper. But in healthcare, it's a little more complicated. Just because I've installed a piece of software doesn't mean it's going to actually improve patient care. It may just be used entirely for the back office, for billing and administrative purposes, with no benefit clinically to the patient. So Congress gave us the authority to say, what does it mean to be a meaningful user of the software? Well, that required some debate. Do we want to maximize the workflows in a fee-for-service environment where the goal could be to see twice as many patients in a day? That could be one meaningful use. Productivity, right? That's a natural and obvious definition. in the transition team before I joined the Obama administration, part of the goal was to sort of say, well, wait a minute, maybe what we want to do is shift the system towards outcomes, have payment models that reward people that deliver better outcomes. And if you fix the paradigm of how you get paid, right, we're all in many ways armchair economists, right? We understand the basic principles of incentives, that if we incentivized longitudinal care, then the technology would be just as important when the patient is in front of us to remind us of all the outstanding care gaps and opportunities to improve what it is that we know about the patient's current system, as well as in between visits, when there may be evidence of a prescription that was ordered but not filled, which might be a signal that there's a problem on how that patient is adhering to their care plan. And so the meaningful use of an organization that's incentivized on long-term outcomes are different than the technical requirements and workflows for those that are just operating in a fee-for-service environment. So our original vision for meaningful use was to use the technology investment to prepare for the future, aka Wayne Gretzky, where the puck is heading. That was a bit challenging for most of the industry. So we ended up getting really a bit of a half-measured IT program. We subsidized the adoption of technology that was predominantly tuned for the fee-for-service era, and we got partial support for longitudinal care, but we didn't quite finish the job. The Trump administration's RFI is an opportunity for us to finish what we started in 2009-2010.
The RFI that you're referring to is the CMS ONC RFI.
You got it.
Tell us more about it, please, Anish. What is the RFI for all of us who don't know about it, right?
Well, it's a wonderful opportunity for the private sector, the nonprofit community, the provider community, the plan community. Everybody can come together to say, hey, here's how we want the healthcare IT system to operate. Here's how we want information flowing. Here's how we want patients to be able to interact with their health information, how clinicians who care for those patients can coordinate that care, how health plans who reimburse that care can engage to ensure that quality is being delivered, quality of care. So it's an open invitation on a dozen or more specific use cases that allow us to imagine a future that is much better than today on the use cases that we never really quite defined when we originally went down the road of meaningful use. It explicitly is asking every stakeholder with a use case to describe what that use case needs. What does a value-based care network need? What do consumers want? How do physicians who are looking to interact with information in real time collect and use that information? Health plans have historically been kept out of our health information networks, or at least the public networks. And so how do we get them in, and in what circumstances? So this is a very short 30-day RFI. By the time our podcast is posted, it'll likely be after the comment period ended. But the good news for our listeners is that life doesn't end when comments are due. Anticipation is that the executive branch will take action over the course of the year. And if I were speculating, there would be a wonderful opportunity for the industry to raise their hands to say, we will voluntarily participate before there's a formal regulation commanding participation. That concept of early adopters raising hands, that's been a hallmark of both my time in government, and I'm grateful the Trump administration seems to have picked that up.
That's great to know, Anish. Thank you for sharing that information. So now I would like to ask you that, you know, based on your experience with the Obama administration or now with your current organization, are there any success stories on AI or interoperability that you would like to share with us?
So we are grateful to support over 150 health systems, health plans, ACO networks, and we're grateful to serve as their core data platform to build that longitudinal patient record. And the great news is when you've done that work, you can then apply use cases on that foundation that will help people be much more successful. And so there are a few areas that three of our customers have been advancing, and we're grateful to share. I think it's the beginning of a new day. The most exciting is in the area of conversational AI, Rohit. One of the challenges when you are managing a population is you're trying to take responsibility for those individuals who may not even come into your clinic on a regular basis. It's the entirety of the population that you have to activate. So you almost have to call them and reach them to remind them. to get the flu vaccine, to check their blood pressure if they've got history of hypertension, to obviously manage their blood sugar if they're diabetics. So, Rohit, the first example is an academic medical center, mostly a fee-for-service organization. They had, let's say, underperformed, to be generous, on these longitudinal measures. So people grade them on a star ratings. The Medicare Advantage program is measured in star ratings. And their physician quality performance might be more of a one or a two star. And the goal is to be north of a four star to get quality incentives. So the organization was struggling a little bit with what to do to close those gaps. Our customer was their enablement partner and brought in a conversational AI workflow that they managed. And it was a wonderful use case. They used the physician's office phone line. They declared that the agent was an automated agent calling on behalf of their doctor. And then they were able to close hundreds, if not thousands of care gaps by communicating with individuals over a 90-day sprint, Rohit. And they were able to turn this organization from a kind of a one or a two star up to a four star in several MA contracts. And it generated north of $6 million of incentive bonuses that they were eligible for, but hadn't qualified for. And that's an example of that co-pilot idea of extending your care management infrastructure to be able to leverage, in this case, conversational agents.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And then if you kind of go on the issue of evidence-based medicine, you know, a big debate in society today is whether or not health plans are denying care with prior authorization steps and so forth. But in many ways, if you flipped the word prior authorization to evidence-based medicine and decision support, you could imagine it being almost like a neighborly nudge to remind you that this particular service for this particular patient, given the history of their digital twins in the database, this is where we recommend that you pursue a course of action. And when it's presented in that way, one of our larger academic centers that happens to have a library of these evidence-based measures, we were able to automate those evidence-based measures. And we've begun piloting, not scaled up yet, but piloting whether or not you can almost have like a AI co-pilot, monitor whether the particular patient in front of you is a good candidate for one of the already approved guidelines within the enterprise. And so that idea of really reducing the cognitive load on making sure that you are up to date with all the evidence-based guidelines, and you can incorporate that feedback as a kindly reminder at the point of care. That shows great promise. And then last but not least, as you know, Rohit, interoperability has been on the minds for many years.
Yes.
Progressing towards a standardized and regulated API, FHIR API, that will be applied universally across payers and providers. CMS was the first to go live with a daily FHIR API for health networks in the ACO REACH program. And this program, this API, it helps move the claims data that's available to our clinician customers from being something that's only useful in an actuarial way 60 days after the date of service to kind of monitor what's happening on the cost side to more of an active feedback to care management, because you might learn as early within as in 5 or 6 days from the last appointment to see a signal that there's been a condition change in your population that you might want to take action on. And so one of our, let's call them advanced primary care customers, that's got the more senior focused, high intensity, complex patient population, they found that the CMS FHIR API closed the coverage gap from what was roughly a 40% ADT coverage to know what is happening in real time to their patient networks. And this may not be as real time, but it's still close enough to real time that it's actionable clinically for a much wider range of the population than those for whom they were getting those ADT feeds.
That's great to know. And then, Anish, moving and thinking a little bit in the future, before the podcast, you and me were talking about the idea behind a healthcare information fiduciary. So you mentioned that. So could you explain more in detail what your thoughts are around that and where we could be headed with that kind of a thing?
Yes. A few pieces of history, and then I'll characterize the fiduciary. In the Obama administration, we proposed a fiduciary rule in the Department of Labor for self-insured employers as they were governing their 401k plans. And unfortunately, Rohit, there was not a lot of transparency. So a lot of financial services firms were charging high fees to employers to manage the 401k plans. And so if you were an employee of a plan that paid 8 to 10% fees when it should be sub 1% fees, if you summed all of that up, it was almost a $3 trillion tax on the employee's retirement income over time. Yeah. If you had, and it was undisclosed. So we didn't really have a lot of transparency. Mm-hmm. More importantly, besides the fee structure, and this is the more nefarious challenge, the brokers might be incentivized to encourage employees to buy financial products that paid them more in commission rather than meet their individual goals in terms of risk tolerance. Mm-hmm. And so we proposed this idea of a fiduciary rule that if you trust me with my information, mm-hmm. and it's a complex subject like financial services, then you must act in my best interest and not based on how you get paid. And that fiduciary standard inspired me to carry it forward into healthcare. Mm-hmm. As we build these healthcare data hubs, as consumers have the right to control who has the access to their information, or more importantly, to request access and to make a copy for their own purposes, that they should be able to trust a marketplace of applications that incorporate AI or other tools to help them not only aggregate their records, but to use them to make better decisions at every step of their journey. So you put those two concepts together. It's a health information network in that it can pull your records, but it operates as a fiduciary in that the advice it delivers is not necessarily in the best interests of the sponsoring organization or a health plan that's looking to get you to go to a lower cost and potentially lower quality setting, or a hospital that might want to steer you to their more expensive site of service because of economic returns, or a pharma company that's trying to get you to move towards a branded drug when a generic alternative might be better for you. This allows us to have a marketplace that we trust that will organize our information and make it accessible for these decision support tools.
Is this something already concrete and coming down the pike? Or is this just an idea at this point in time?
It's a yes and.
Okay.
I'm one of the co-founders of the Karen Alliance. This is a bipartisan effort with Governor Leavitt, Dr. David Blumenthal, and the OG national coordinator, Dr. David Brailer. And the four of us conceived of a program that's now led by our friend Ryan Howells to bring about a category of apps, consumer-facing apps, that adhere to a voluntary code of conduct. Now, this tackles one part of a fiduciary, that you will be transparent in the uses of my data so that I can trust what it is that you're doing. It actually goes beyond HIPAA to include disclosure of what you do on the de-identified uses of my data, which is not something that you see from your hospital or your insurance company today. So the Karen Alliance Code of Conduct is a step in the direction of a full fiduciary. But we don't have the full fiduciary construct designed yet, Rohit. You combine the data sharing rights with a forthcoming AI code of conduct. And I think in the combination of the two, probably as early as this fall, we're going to see a set of consumer apps that say, share with me your lab results, Rohit, and I'll give you advice as to what you should do next, which we've already seen demoed on these ChatGPT-like products.
That's great to know. Now, touching upon one other thing, Anish, before we wrap up our podcast on the subject of innovation, you actually wrote a book, The Innovative State, and it's been a while since, you know, it's been in publishing. So what are some of the lessons learned and what's still relevant and what are some of your thoughts for the future for that?
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah. So I was inspired by Sam Petroda, Rohit, if you recall from
India. Oh, yeah, I do, actually.
So Sam chose the more innovative path when India lacked access to phone service, right? 300,000 phone lines for 300 million people back in the 80s. Sam, after effectively selling a business and having the freedom to go back to India for like a rupee a year salary or something, said, look, either I buy Western telecommunications equipment and try to get it connected to every remote village in India at a massive cost, or I try to inspire the market to like maybe deregulate and make it easier. Neither of those pathways, which you can see in the U.S. Democratic Party about subsidizing public good, or Republican Party, deregulate, let the market solve it. He said the third way. And that third way was to apply innovation. So he recruited, as you know, several hundred brilliant young minds into an R&D factory, and they built a de novo digital first telecommunications network. And by that design structure allowed for industry commercialization. And within a decade, they were able to get phone service to every remote village, the STD booths, as you recall.
Of course.
So I was inspired to approach problems in the public sector in the same way. Where might there be a hidden third path that brings about the innovative capacity of the country? Mm-hmm. And so the heart of my book was to identify the strategies that problem solvers could deploy inside the government and outside the government that build on these core principles of handshakes and handoffs. Mm-hmm. Much of that which benefits from innovation is bipartisan, and it requires Washington to sort of create the pathway, but it's a handoff to the private sector to execute the plans. So this notion of a handshake in Washington resulting in a handoff to the private nonprofit sectors is a core tenet of my philosophy, and that involves opening up government data, inspiring regulated interoperability standards, issuing outcomes-based payment models, and thinking about ways to source talent in the government for tours of duty to upskill what happens in the public sector. So all of those ideas are still relevant today, Rohit, and I really appreciate you giving me a chance to say a few words about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So as we end the podcast, Anish, any parting thoughts or any final words for the audience that you would like to share? And
yes, well, in the spirit of Patty's conversations in the past with many of the tech leaders, this is our chance to raise our hands. Yeah. If you're an early adopter, if you see the future and you want to have a hand in bringing it to life, your hand should raise. And we would love to tap into that talent and collectively work with the public sector. As I mentioned, the Trump administration's RFI is going to involve a series of actions over the course of the summer, the fall, and maybe the winter. Yeah. And the more people that want to raise their hands through your program, I'd love to hear from you directly, or you can reach out to Washington. Let's get those early adopters organized, and let's work faster to test, validate, and then we can scale through the rest of the sector what works.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you, Anish. This was really a great conversation. Totally enjoyed it, and hoping to bring you back another time pretty soon.
Thank you, Rohit. Appreciate you having me.